They're buying fully automatic AKs, they're buying RPGs, grenades, belt-fed squad weapons. We triggered a arms race in the cartels by attempting to do regulation here in the States. That's a fourth order consequence.
So you're saying that the cartels don't obey the regulations?
Really?
Hello, welcome to episode 14 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. I recently attended the Texas Bitcoin Conference and had a great time. I met fellow LTB podcasters John Barrett and John Bush, people I listened to well before I started this podcast. I also got to meet some Bitcoin heroes of mine, as well as many listeners to this show. To kick off my content from the conference, I bring you this informative but somewhat scary talk about cryptocurrency regulation, delivered by the very knowledgeable Carol Van Cleef. The presentation is followed by a panel discussion, and it ends with questions from the audience. I hope you'll tune in for upcoming episodes of The Bitcoin Game that will include details on what it was like for me to attend my first major Bitcoin conference, and you'll also get to hear my interviews with Bitcoiners including Eric Voorhees, Bruce Fenton, Sean Wilkinson, John Bush, and many, many more. So let's go back to Sunday morning, March 28th, 2015, at the Texas Bitcoin Conference at the Moody Theater in downtown Austin.
How are you all today? You're a brave sort to be out here at 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning for a regulatory presentation. But we are hopeful in the next few minutes to give you a flavor, at least a slight taste of what we've been up against over the last year. And from there, we're going to have a panel discussion with several people, including a representative of the Securities and Exchange Commission from the enforcement section, who will give us some highlights of what the SEC is up to. So with that, let's get started. How many of you are entrepreneurs in the room? Okay, how many of you would like to have $7,658 towards your company? Well, we'll get there. But that's a pretty big number, isn't it? That would help a lot of companies in this space right now. We're going to come back to that number in a minute. Okay, I want to start out with some common myths in this arena, because no matter how many times I'm talking with clients, prospective clients, with folks like you at conferences like this, these are the kinds of things I hear. First, the laws are still evolving. No one has decided yet what applies to me. How many of you fit into that category, that you feel that way? I guess you wouldn't be here right now if you didn't think something applied. Oh, I saw one hand go up. Okay, the next one is, they did that last week, being the competition or somebody else in the space, and nothing happened to them, so it's okay for me to do it. How many of you had thoughts like that? Hey, I saw somebody go out with whatever they did last week and they're still alive today, so it's okay. I think when we get to our SEC enforcement representative today, I think the tone may change a little bit. The next one I hear a lot is, well, I'm not planning on doing business with criminals, so why do I need to be concerned about this anti-money laundering compliance or this other stuff? Another one, see if we can get it to come up here. Okay, no one bad is going to use my system. Again, that's something I hear. I'm not going to do business with criminals, and nobody's going to come and bad and use it. Well, the one thing we know is that criminals are the first adopters in emerging payments. Then the other one was, and I hear this more times than I probably would like, is it doesn't matter who I do business with. I can do business with whomever I want to. There are, you know, nobody could stop me in doing business with whomever I want to. Well, unfortunately, that's a fallacy that if that's what you believe, again, I'm going to talk a little bit more in a few minutes about it. But if that's the way you view it, you need to be aware of what you're up against and what your potential liability is. Another one, BSA. How many of you know what BSA stands for? I have some other terms I would use, but it's the Bank Secrecy Act. Bank Secrecy Act doesn't apply to me. I'm not a money service business. Thank you. This is just not, an issue that I have to worry about. OFAC? Now, how many? Does anybody know what OFAC means in this room? Oh, I know you know. but yes, so we've got a few, but every hand in this room should be up on OFAC. And I'll tell you why in a minute again. AML compliance, maybe Bank Secrecy Act, again, doesn't apply to me because I only do crypto to crypto. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands on that one. But again, if that's where you are philosophically, especially with respect to anti-money laundering compliance, I urge you to pay careful attention over the next few minutes. Some more myths, and not to go into great detail here, but compliance with the Bank Secrecy Act is the same thing as anti-money laundering compliance. Another one is I'm doing KYC, therefore I'm BSA AML compliant. Again, I have this under the myths category. Maybe I should have misnomers. It's sort of, not quite, maybe, right? But if this is what you believe, you need to pay more attention. OFAC compliance is the same thing as AML compliance. So I didn't even say what OFAC was, but it's the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And a lot of people say, oh, I checked that list. I'm doing AML compliance. I'm done. Stay tuned. Fraud is the same thing as money laundering. And I have my fraud solution, so I don't have to do anything more. I mean, I'm good. I'm compliant. I'm looking for fraud. Again, if that fraud's all that you're looking for, if you're even looking for a fraud and doing something in AML compliance, that's just the starting point for you. It's a good starting point, but it's not everything. Then I'm checking the OFAC list, therefore I'm compliant. Again, if you're checking that list, whatever that list is, but there's a list you need to check, that's not going to get you all the way there either. In this world, I think many of your business models depend upon probably other companies. There are other pieces of the puzzle that are necessary for you to come forward with your business model. So often what we'll hear is, well, somebody else is doing it. That company that I'm partnered up with is doing it, or that company. And it becomes a case of like this. Everybody thinks everybody else is doing it. And one of the things you need to be clearer about is that who is actually doing it and understanding what they're doing, because if you don't do that, you're exposing yourself to significant liability. And then this one, probably more times than I would like to hear, it pains me every time, not just because I make money this way, but because I actually care about what happens to people. And I don't like seeing people go to jail. I don't like seeing them get fined, having their business models destroyed because of a lack of understanding of compliance in this area. But it's not now. I'm just too busy. Every cent I have really needs to go to that software development. I need to hire another programmer. I need a marketer. I just got to get my business off the ground. Once I do, I'll worry about it. And in the arena that we're in today, 2 years ago, you had a little time, but not entirely. There are people who got caught up. But today, the shall we say, the noose is getting tighter by the moment. Okay, so, I think I went too far on that one. If we can go back. I just want to give you a little flavor of the statutory scheme that exists in the world of anti-money laundering compliance. And I say anti-money laundering compliance. I think I put it more under the category of the criminal stuff. But there's some things up there that you may not have seen before. Everybody thinks about BSA. But there are the money laundering criminal statutes. And BSA may only apply to you if you're a money service business. However, just by virtue of the fact that you're sitting in your seat in this room right now, the money laundering criminal statutes apply to you as well. And under the federal sentencing guidelines that the courts use when they decide if something's gone bad and you're standing in front of them, what they're going to look at is whether you have an anti-money laundering compliance program. not one that's required under the Bank Secrecy Act because you're an MSB, but just because you're sitting in the room right now and you're running a business. Every business should be considering, what is the risk that I'm potentially going to be used or abused by criminals? Then we have the terrorist financing criminal statutes, which are much like the AML statutes. And oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you that you don't have to be actively engaged in the money laundering process or financing terrorism. But if you're aiding and abetting, in any way helping provide somebody to move their money, that puts you at risk. Even more importantly, and the thing that should concern you most because you're sitting in these seats, is the fact that we have this concept of willful blindness. And that concept of willful blindness is such that if you had asked the question, you would have found out. And that's what trips up people more than anything else, is being willfully blind to a situation, which means not having appropriate compliance program in place. And again, it doesn't matter. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn if you're a money service business, because you've got these obligations under the criminal statutes. And then we have OFAC, and I've got a slide I want to get to in a minute on that. But I wanted to also point out one other item on here. Oops, now I'm going too fast, or in the wrong, totally wrong direction. Okay, I wanted to point out, we have asset forfeiture. That's a motivator from the law enforcement perspective to come out and seize assets. And we've heard of asset seizures in this arena, and then followed by forfeiture. It is a true exposure that organizations have. I wanted to point out this 18 U.S.C. 1345. This is a different statute. This is actually a civil statute that the Department of Justice has started using against payment processors. And it allows them all of the authorities they really have under the criminal forfeiture provisions to come out, but they don't have to prove that you've been involved in a crime to necessarily do it. This is what's being used in Operation Choke Point. But it's something you should be aware that there's yet another tool in the toolbox. And then we've got the Unfair and Deceptive Practices Acts, both at the federal level and the state level, which is administered by the Federal Trade Commission and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I highlight that because MoneyGram ended up first being subject to an $18 million fine under the UDAP provisions, Unfair and Deceptive Practices, which then eventually led to a $100 million fine and a deferred prosecution agreement, all because of a bunch of consumer complaints that started, filtering as they went through the process. They realized that they didn't have a good program in place to look at the kind of activity and how criminals were ultimately using the process and abusing consumers. And again, it wasn't something they were doing directly, but they were being willfully blind to the action. And obviously, we have state laws. So Bank Secrecy Act, I'm not going to go into this. You probably have heard a lot. Record keeping reporting, this is where you have to register as a money service business. You have to file SARs, CTRs if you're handling cash. You have to have the anti-money laundering compliance program. It is definitely a key provision. And I can't get this to move. Is it possible for you to move the next slide? Okay. Okay, criminal statutes, I told you they're there. Here's it. They are for your reference. Basically, they apply to any U.S. person. So by virtue of being in this room right now, you are a U.S. person. OFAC, this is what I want to point out to you, because this is probably the biggest train or engine coming down the tracks right now towards this industry. Is this applies, again, to all U.S. persons, and it is an obligation. You're not required to have a compliance program. You're not required to check the so-called OFAC list, which has the bad guys on it, the really bad guys. But if you don't have a compliance program in place, and if you are not taking reasonable steps, if something goes wrong, if you do a transaction with somebody who's on that OFAC list or otherwise covered by OFAC limitations, it's more or less a strict liability statute, and then it just becomes an argument about the penalty. So where's that $7.6 million come into play? Remember I asked you at the beginning? Would you like to have that amount? That's what PayPal was assessed this week. For what? A total of, I forget how many transactions altogether, but a total of $45,000 in transactions for doing 136 transactions of a total of $7,000 with somebody who was on the OFAC list over a period of time. And you know what? PayPal actually had a compliance program in place that was doing things. But as a result of this agreement with OFAC now, one, they've already spent a lot of money getting more OFAC into place. They're having to pay a fine, and they're going to be under a great deal of scrutiny for a long period of time to come. But think about it, for about $45,000 that were noted in the order, they're paying almost $7.7 million. You're going to hear a lot more about OFAC. There was one case a couple weeks ago when someone tweeted out that they had used a particular provider to send money to ISIS. This is an extraordinarily high priority item for the US government right now. And they know, they're aware of the digital currency world. So, all right, we're gonna move on quickly to our panel. And I guess if they wanna come on up. And while they're coming up, I've got a couple of slides I'll give you a chance to take a look at. This is sort of the evolution of compliance in this area. And a lot of our law is coming from cases that are out there, from deferred prosecution agreements, plea agreements, from enforcement actions. And we're going to explore more of these. And I also want to note for you that we're not isolated here in the U.S. in terms of what we're doing, but around the world, everyone's looking at regulation in this area at different levels, but we're going to talk a little bit more about that during the panel. Compliance challenges for you, as I said, you've got to decide whether you're subject to the Bank Secrecy Act or not, but that's not where it stops. If you think it stops right there, you probably, I won't ask you to leave, because please stay, because I think you'll learn more in the next 40 minutes. But if you are, you've got things that you need to do, and even if you don't, remember, you are subject to those federal criminal statutes, plus every U.S. person is subject to the OFAC rules, too. And those OFAC rules cover any transaction or dealing with anyone, depending upon the program, the nature of the program. So it's very serious stuff we're dealing with here.
This episode of The Bitcoin Game is brought to you by the biggest Bitcoin event to come to Los Angeles to date. This one-day Bitcoin conference is called The State of Digital Money and takes place on April 18th. Speakers at this event include Jeff Garzik, Brock Pierce, Connie Galippi, Michael Turpin, Paul Snow, Steve Bureaugard, and many others. I've created a Bitly link that includes a 20% discount for the Bitcoin Game listeners. Just go to bit.ly/LABTC. Or if you shy away from URL shorteners, just Google The State of Digital Money and you'll find the event. When you click through to Eventbrite to buy your tickets, click the text that says enter promotional code and enter Bitcoin Game with no space between the words, and you'll receive your 20% discount. You can also find the URL in this episode's show notes. Hope to see you there. Today's magic word is comply. C-O-M-P-L-Y. Use the magic word to claim your share of this week's listener distribution of LTB coin on letstalkbitcoin.com.
Okay.
Going to let me join. I'm just going to sit here as the non-regulatory member of the regulatory panel. Thank you.
Thank you. And what I'd like to do is have each one of our panelists, starting here on the left, introduce themselves, and everyone's mic'd up, right? So, an introduction of where you're from, who you are, where you're from, and then we'll circle back and ask everyone for a moment or two of their thoughts on this issue.
I'm Joel Laud. I'm with the Texas Department of Public Safety, Intelligence and Counterterrorism Division, and I have to say clearly that my comments are not part of the government of Texas or the Department of Public Safety, but are my own opinions. They tell me to say that.
I'm Timothy Evans. I'm a senior counsel with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. I'm out of the Fort Worth Regional Office. And likewise, my comments today are my own and do not represent those of the commission.
I'm Elena Margarito. I'm a Brazilian lawyer. I'm a partner at HMOE Advisor, which is a law firm based, actually specialized on internet and new businesses. I'm a co-founder of the Brazilian Bitcoin Foundation. And also, I've been engaged in mentoring Bitcoin-related startups in Brazil.
Hi, I'm Perianne Boring, and I'm the founder and president of the Chamber of Digital Commerce. We're a trade association that represents the digital currency, digital asset industry in Washington, D.C., and we promote pro-growth policies on behalf of our members.
My name is Paul Snow. I happen to run the Texas Bitcoin Conference and a CEO of Factum, a major sponsor of the conference, and a Bitcoin activist and essentially someone under the purview of our esteemed guests and lobbyists. Thank you very much for letting me sit here. Thank you, Carol.
Well, I guess what I'd like to do ideally is start with our SEC representative. I had another slide, and the slide's not up, but it was buckets. And the idea is that we really have a number of different buckets of issues that we're dealing with here. And I think one of the buckets that's been filling up probably as fast as any has been in the arena of how the securities laws apply. So could you first lay out for us what your views are on sort of the different, if we break that bucket down into some pieces, what are those pieces?
Of course. The commission regulates offerings of securities, not Bitcoin. So what we look for in any case that we're investigating is whether there's an offering of securities. And if there is, whether there's any fraud related to that offering. What we've seen so far, there have been three cases filed that happen to involve Bitcoin. One of those, the Shavers case, was mentioned earlier this morning. That was an offering fraud case, so it's what we call a Section 5 case, an unregistered offering of securities. So if you're going to offer securities, you have to either register that offering or you have to have an exemption from registering that offering. That case also involved a fraud, and so that was what we call a Section 10B, or a Section 17A. Those are anti-fraud provisions, and that case happened to have both the offering fraud, the unregistered offering and the offering fraud. There have been two other cases. The Satoshi Dice case was primarily an unregistered offering case. And then also the BTC and LTC stock trading case was a Section 5 case, so an unregistered offering case. That one also had an unregistered broker-dealer, so someone who is involved in trading in securities for the accounts of others. And if you're operating as a broker-dealer, you also have to be registered. So that would be someone who was an unregistered broker-dealer.
That was Burnside out of BTCT, right?
That's correct.
Running out of Belize.
Burnside.
They were operating out of Belize.
Okay,
so we've got Ponzi schemes. Mm-hmm. We've got unregistered securities.
Right.
We have the operation without being appropriately licensed or registered as a broker dealer. What about the issue of operating a securities exchange?
Sure. Yeah. If you are operating a securities exchange, you also have to be registered. Registration and disclosure are two of the key hallmarks of all SEC enforcement and kind of what we do to fulfill our mission to protect investors, maintain fair, orderly, and balanced markets, and promote capital formation. And so the notion of registration, if you're broker dealer and exchange or offering of securities, is key. So if you are involved in securities, if you're going to be involved in any kind of offering dealing with securities, you should go talk to someone about whether that's going to involve the SEC. There are a number of ways that can come up that should be really looked into before you start going too far down the road with any security.
Well, that raises a question of how does a case come before the SEC? How do you end up working on a matter?
Most cases come to us because people lose money and they're not happy about it, and so they complain. And they complain to us, and then we will go from there. We also do monitoring of, and I would call that probably little m monitoring. We read the newspapers, we read websites, and you can see things that are happening, and we will look into that to see if those offerings would are registered, if they would qualify as an offering under our definition. I would say most of the cases we get, though, are complaints from people who've lost money.
And then typically, what's the first step that happens in a case like that? You become aware somebody's complained that they've lost money, or you've read something in the paper. What happens next?
Google is often a first step. No, we're just trying to educate ourselves as much as we can on who's involved, what they're doing. If there's any publicly available documents, we're going to go find those. In Bitcoin-related cases, for example, in the Trendon Shavers case, I would assume that there was a lot of reading of the Bitcoin forums and the discussions that were going on of the people who were invested in that offering and who lost money from that offering. Those can be all very informative places for us to review, but it is about learning as much as we can about a case to kind of build a foundation of knowledge that we can start analyzing whether this is something that does invoke our jurisdiction.
Well, I have a question. You mentioned that a lot of it is activated by complaints. Mm-hmm. When Ben Lasky was asked how many complaints there were about Bitcoin businesses, he admitted that they had none. How many complaints have come to the SEC, for instance, about the BTCT exchange? I mean, did you really get complaints from that situation?
Sure. I can't actually comment on any of that internal information, but it is fair to say that we do receive complaints and on a number of investments, ones that UCS file cases on and others that we might investigate and find that there's no reason to pursue any further action.
Is that stuff subject to FOIA requests? Have anybody done that sort of thing?
FOIA, there is a lot of FOIA operations within the commission.
Now, there's been a lot of chatter within the industry about letters going out to different companies from the SEC. What are those letters, and what are the purposes of those letters?
I think that there might have been a later update on that article that pretty well refuted the notion that there were a mass number of letters that were sent out on that. That is not something that we would traditionally do. There are certain restrictions on that. So I'm not certain that actually did happen. Certainly in individual cases, we will send letters. But as far as a mass mailing, that's not normally within our operations.
I wasn't going to put you on the spot with the mass mailing, but I was hoping you could tell us about the letter itself and what the implications of that letter are.
Sure, and there's a number of different ways those letters can initially go out. In a case where we might get a complaint from an investor, we've gone on, we've done some public research on the offering that's being made, the representations that are made as part of that offering. We've probably tried to test those ourselves as best we can from the publicly available information. We might obtain other information that we're permitted to in order to test those representations. And then when we decide we want to speak with the person we're looking at, oftentimes we'll send out a couple of different letters might go out initially. It could be a subpoena asking you to provide us with documents to come in and talk with us in testimony. It could be a voluntary request for you to give us information. It could be just a letter that says we're looking at you and we want you to retain all of your documents, what would be known as a litigation hold or document preservation notice. So it can take a couple different forms. Sometimes it's just we want to talk. Would you be willing to come in and talk with us?
Well, I think a provision in some of these letters that's confused people is the extent to which this is public information. And I know that there's generally a disclosure to say that this is not necessarily a formal investigation yet. My understanding is that that's done so that, especially if it's a publicly traded company that gets it, they don't necessarily have to make an immediate disclosure to the public. Is there any more that you, any further enlightenment you can give us on that?
So that's there's a lot of inside baseball here, I guess. We would never tell a company whether they should or should not disclose whether we're looking at them. That's always left up to the company, and they make those determinations. But there are different stages of what we do. So we might have a matter under inquiry, which is what we would call a MUI or a MUI, depending on what office of the SEC you work in. And what that says is we want to look at something. We think there might be something there. We have no formal authority to subpoena anyone at that time. So that's often where you'll see a voluntary document request. And often people who work in our industry, defense attorneys who work in our industry, might be able to make certain determinations about the level of interest in our case at that point based on whether we have a matter under inquiry or an investigation. Once we have an investigation, that might signify a more formal interest in the case. It might not. It might be a matter of some other administrative issues that come along with having an investigation as opposed to a MUI. One of those things is we can obtain formal order authority once we have an investigation, which allows us to subpoena documents and to subpoena people for testimony and allows us to put people under oath for purposes of testimony. So there are certain things you can glean from that.
How long does it take to put a case like this together?
That largely depends. We have TRO cases that have been done, a temporary restraining order. So if we want to go out, if we think someone is about to dissipate a large amount of investor money that we would not be able to later bring back for defrauded investors, that can be done in a matter of days. Investigations can also take a very long time, depending on the amount of information we have to go through. And so that can take a year or more. I would say between 9 months, 18 months is a fairly normal life cycle for a case, but it can hit anywhere in the spectrum as well.
So the fact that something happened last week, someone did something last week, nothing's happened to them, doesn't mean that they may be in the clear for what they've done.
Absolutely, and that ties back to something you asked earlier. Our cases are confidential, they're non-public. If we've asked for information from a company, the company might know that we're looking at them, but they might not have disclosed that to the public, which can certainly be proper at times. So we might be filing a case tomorrow on a company that that you have no idea we've been looking at for the past 2 years. And just because they did that act 2 years ago and you haven't seen anything come out of that yet, doesn't mean it's not coming.
Now, you work primarily in the civil area. At what point might a case become criminal, and how would you then interact with the Department of Justice?
Sure. So I work exclusively in the civil area, but we often coordinate and work with criminal authorities. One of the provisions that empowers the SEC, that created the SEC, allows us to work with criminal authorities. So if we see a case that we think they might have interest in, we're always happy to refer them that case, let them know what we're looking at, and once they get it, it's theirs. That portion of it is theirs. We continue our case on our own, and then they have their own version of the case. If they're interested in it, oftentimes they are, oftentimes they're not.
Joel, could you tell us what your agency does and how it's come into the world of digital currencies?
The biggest threat to Texas currently are the Mexican cartels. The cartels do an estimated, and the estimates range from $38 to $70 billion a year in drug, human trafficking, prostitution, extortion, kidnapping. In the last year, southbound money, our seizure of southbound money has dropped by half. We can directly attribute to that to the cartels finding better, more invisible methodologies for hiding the money they send south. They are massively effective, very agile, very nimble financial institutions, and they basically run Mexico. They are who we combat against every day, and we come to the Bitcoin world and cryptocurrency in general looking, going, what are they doing, how are they doing it, and how well are they doing it? And our estimate is they do it very well, they're very aware, and they hire the very best.
Are you in a position to give us a sense of the kind of activity that you see, you know, sort of a typical fact pattern where the cryptocurrencies are involved?
Not so much cryptocurrency, but I can give you an evolution because we're still looking at cryptocurrency. Historically, we would southbound money. You pull over a truck for a routine traffic stop. We get a dog on the truck. Money has a scent. Dogs will hit on the money. Actually, it's the drugs on the money, but they'll hit on the money. We open the back of a large console television. There's $250,000 in green folding. Put it in your pocket. Cash. Real money cash. You go to a stash house. There's a pallet of shrink-wrapped money. Cash. Green folding money. Cash. That used to be the case. Now we're seeing value-add cards, charge cards, you buy at Target or Walmart or any place else, loaded up with cash. And dogs don't hit on those. We find them by accident. We find them by happenstance. You open a suitcase, there's 1,000 cards with a valuation of anywhere from $1,000 to $5,000 on them. That's $1 million sitting there, up to $5 million. The problem is, by the time we get that case open, or get the suitcase open, the follow car, or the escort car that's running with them, has already pulled over, told them to transfer the money from those cards to other accounts. So the cards are now worthless. That's the evolution they're working. We have every confidence they're going to move into cryptocurrency if they have not already.
To what extent do you interact with federal authorities?
We have a full-time representative at DPS headquarters in the Fusion Center from FISMA, and every day we talk with them.
And can you give us a sense of, it sounds like you're still in the learning process here.
We always are.
We've seen a couple of cases where cryptocurrencies have been implicated. How would you go about building one of those cases from an investigatory standpoint?
Right now, we do not have officers. We have very few officers that have enough knowledge on cryptocurrency to build an effective case. The Department of Justice and the Attorney General's Office of Texas are in a learning phase on that, and we have not had a case yet where the major component of it is cryptocurrency. We've seen cryptocurrency involved, but our concern is every time you add a rule set or a regulation, you turn up the dial a little bit on what they're doing and encourage them to take a different path. Our take right now is Bitcoin is a symptom of regulation, and the more regulation is going to cause more cryptocurrency.
You're going to have to repeat that because I don't follow the logic.
Okay. If you build a set of rules, the cartels...
Can you get your mic closer?
Oh, I'm sorry. If you build a set of rules, the cartels, criminal organizations, are very good at finding ways around those rules.
Okay.
The more regulations you add, the more people flee out of conventional currency into cryptocurrency and like equivalents.
So the rules you're talking about are the rules that you're applying to the regular banking financials?
To regular banking and even crypto banking.
Or in the crypto. So you add more rules in crypto, there are going to be more people using it for criminal
purposes.
They're going
to find different methods.
Different methods. Okay.
We're always in a Red Queen's race.
Uh-huh.
And we're always in last place in that race because law is slower than technology.
Well, I would point out that cryptocurrencies provide a permanent immutable record. So one of the problems that criminal organizations have is that they not only have to try to avoid something, but they have to try to avoid something you might do later. And this makes it very, very hard compared to cash, because you know once you move cash, there's no necessarily a record, right?
But all regulations have second and third and fourth order consequences.
Right.
And when we add a regulation to cryptocurrency, conventional currency, everything else, the second, third, fourth order consequences, we can't see over the horizon what's going to happen. When the president and the attorney general regulated or made motions to regulate weapons and ammo, every American that could went out and bought weapons and ammo, and they wiped out the shelves. That forced the cartels to go to the Mexican Honduran, Guatemalan, Colombian, Venezuelan military for weapons, and then Southeast Asia and North Africa for their weapon sets. We caused an arms race among the cartels inadvertently by those attempts at regulation.
Can you talk a little bit more about what types of regulations that you guys would potentially be looking at and what types of unintended consequences you're trying to avoid here?
I don't know enough, and I don't think we know enough about cryptocurrency to map that out closely, but I'll walk you through what happened with weapons and walk it to its fourth order consequence. I think it gives us a good parallel. When our president, attorney general, said they're going to regulate automatic weapons or semi-automatic weapons and ammo, every American that could, or even some that couldn't or shouldn't have, went out and bought weapons and ammo. You could go into a gun store and there were no weapons available. For us, weapons are a get-to. For the cartels, they're a have-to. When they woke up in the morning, sat on the side of the bed and got the first cigarette, they had to figure out where to get their next load of weapons. They went to the Mexican military, Honduran, Guatemalan, Venezuelan, Colombian, and then they went to Southeast Asia and North Africa for weapons. We found out about it when three Gulf cartel members were killed in Tunis, Tunisia by going the wrong way on a roundabout. When the report came in, they had $250,000 in green folding money cash in a bag, and they had a case of Czechoslovakian Scorpion automatic weapons. They were buying weapons. From that, we now have, and when they go into those markets, they're not buying semi-automatic rifles that they get in the States. They're buying fully automatic AKs, they're buying RPGs, grenades, belt-fed squad weapons. We triggered a arms race in the cartels by attempting to do regulation here in the States. That's a fourth order consequence.
So you're saying that the cartels don't obey the regulations?
Really?
Does that have any implication to the SEC and the way in the regulations that are going on in the SEC? Do you see that sort of thing?
We do not see arms races generally.
Arms races. unintended consequences when you apply laws certain ways.
I'm sure there are. You know, as it relates to Bitcoin, we don't regulate Bitcoin itself. So I would say no. But sure, I think with anything there are unintended consequences.
And a major distinction we would want to make here with the arms race that you're referencing is these are tangible assets, and cryptocurrencies are digital assets. And when you try to ban a digital asset, there's really no way to do that. You can just make it illegal and push it into the black market without shutting off the internet. You can't delete people's access to it. So the unintended consequence here potentially could be pushing everything into the dark web, and we've seen that flourish very much. We do need to approach any type of rules, regulations, any type of ways to regulate this in a careful way, because you hit that fine line of pushing this into a black market, which is going to be that much more harder to enforce.
Can I get a quick check? How many here have read Stealth of Nations? Stealth of Nations, not Wealth of Nations. Stealth of Nations. It's about the systemd economy. If you're not aware of it, the underground economy on this planet is the third largest economy on the planet, second only to China and then the United States and then System D.
But that's not possible. We have AML and CYK. You can't have an economy like that, right?
Again, the cartels can buy the very best bankers, lawyers, investors. They have an unlimited pool of money. They have an unlimited personnel pool. And they don't really suffer regulations or rules very much.
Well, at least we're making it interesting at 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning. I think it's important to note that, Joel, your focus is primarily with respect to the drug trade and the cartels, correct?
And terrorism.
Okay.
The same architecture for weapons coming out of North Africa and Southeast Asia built an architecture for drugs out of Central America, Mexico, going into North Africa and into Europe in exchange for weapons.
Well, one thing that has certainly evolved in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years in the law enforcement community is to unravel the pieces of criminal activities to follow the money. And I think that we've seen in the press in particular over the last year, is there's been a great deal of effort, especially in the intelligence community, to understand the flow of value through cryptocurrencies because of, and it's accelerated because of the threats associated with ISIS, which sort of takes us back to my comments earlier about PayPal and the action taken against PayPal recently. Mm-hmm. So why don't we shift gears here, since we've introduced the corridor, the Latin America corridor, in this conversation. Helena, can you give us a little bit of a flavor of what's going on in Latin America, South America, with respect to regulation of cryptocurrencies and digital currencies more generally?
Yeah, sure. Well, I can give a more accurate framework on Brazil, but I know what's going on in some other countries as well. So as far as Brazil is concerned, what we have is that the Brazilian Central Bank has issued a statement back in February 2014 stating that they could, but they are not regulating Bitcoins yet. So basically it left a room for discussion and for people to be aware and afraid of any type of regulation that could be enforced. And one thing for people to know is that when it comes to the Brazilian Central Bank, regulations are pretty tough. So they require minimum capital, they require lots of operational skills and compliance that is pretty heavy for startups, for instance. Actually, this gave a good hint that they are not regulating, so you're not doing anything illegal yet, but once they decide to do so, you may incur into a lot of costs to comply with that. This is one thing. Also, the IRS has issued, they have declared to the press, actually, that people should declare that their Bitcoins as assets, they should tax capital gains. They have mentioned nothing about mining. They have mentioned nothing about using the blockchain as a transaction processor, etc. So they have been pretty, not naive, but shallow on the analysis and the statement that they gave. They did not actually realize that there can be many uses and many forms that you see Bitcoin and the taxation applied to each one of those should be different as well. And also, as for the Brazilian SEC, there is one case that's dated back in 2013 of a person that has decided to offer what was called Bitcoin Rain. So he basically offered to some people a guaranteed investment of 13% a month or so. So they should deposit their Bitcoins, they would always get profit, etc., etc. So what happened in I'm going to be very brief on that. What happened was that this person told that he was hacked and all the Bitcoins were missed. And we are talking about 4,000 Bitcoins. I know some people that sold a house to buy everything in Bitcoin and got everything ripped off. So this person was adverted by the Brazilian SEC to say he was not authorized to make any public offer, that he was not an authorized agent to sell the investment that he was selling, but that was it because that was dated in 2013. And since Bitcoin was pretty new at that time, especially in Brazil, that we only had one business dealing with that, they just decided to advert the person. But what happened in the next step was pretty bad. Now they are discussing who is going to sue, for how much, for the Bitcoins, for the money, and that's been going on and on. So basically, we have authorities seeing what's going on, but they are pretty much lost. They do not know how to regulate. And this actually to investors and companies, serious companies that are willing to engage in those businesses in Brazil especially, it's not a good scenario because they want to be not sure, because in Brazil you're not sure of anything, but the most certain as possible that they are doing something legal and that they are building
a business that can work in a long-term period. So this is what we have been facing so far. Also, yesterday I was speaking to a colleague on the Argentinian scenario, on the Mexican scenario, and what we have many laws in common, and basically one thing that is common to all the Latin America countries is that for you to be able to buy Bitcoins, to enter the Bitcoin market, you necessarily need to go through a regulated market, which is basically the financial institutions one. And when it comes to Argentina, for instance, banks are blocking any Bitcoin-related transactions. They do not allow Bitcoin exchanges to have a bank account. Also in Brazil, some banks are also going the same line. We know, like, the biggest Brazilian bank do not allow any Brazilian Bitcoin exchange to have a bank account. And that there's not necessarily a reason. They just say that they do not have any commercial interest on that.
I could ask for a show of hands of the audience, those of you operating businesses, or even on a personal level, that have had issues with your bank accounts in the past year. It's definitely an issue. Our government hasn't said that banks can't bank them, but as a practical matter, The kind of pressure that's been put on the banks has done that. Perry Ann, would you like to talk a little bit about the financial access issue and the efforts of the chamber with respect to that?
Right, and this issue really came to our attention because so many people in the community were reaching out and saying we cannot get or keep or establish a banking relationship. And there's only a few companies that have been successful in doing so. So we've taken on an initiative at the Chamber of Digital Commerce. We have a financial access task force, and we're working on helping bridge the gap between the industry and Wall Street and the bank regulators as well. And we've been to some meetings at the U.S. Treasury on issues of MSBs, who have traditionally had very difficult times getting bank accounts way before Bitcoin's existence. So we've been able to bring this issue to the attention of the regulators to help start educating bank regulators on what the issues are. A lot of them weren't really aware of it, but through our work, we've been able to bring this to their attention. And what we're finding that the biggest issue is compliance, that companies don't necessarily understand what their compliance obligations are. So we've even developed, Carol's been integral in putting this together, an AML compliance bootcamp for digital currency. And we're the only organization that offers AML compliance for digital currency. We have a coursework that's been approved by ACAMS and the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. You can earn CLE credit for this, and we've been speaking with the bank regulators, including FinCEN, about this program we've put together, and they're very supportive of these efforts. And so it's this type of work that is really helping bring more educational efforts to the industry, the regulators, and the bankers to help get over this this issue. And without a bank account, it's really a life aligned to business. So it's absolutely essential that this is overcome in some way, shape, or form. And so if anybody needs help establishing a banking relationship, please come talk to us, because we have some tools out there for the industry.
And Paul, do you have, as the industry rep up here, and we know what your political views are generally, but what are your thoughts on what you've heard today?
I think this is all really rather fascinating. I do think that pointing out the unintended consequences of regulation is something that we're not seeing the regulators talk about. Ben Losky has completely ignored that to talk about that nasty New York guy. No, I didn't say that. That wonderful New York representative looking out for the best interests of New Yorkers. I also think, and it's unfortunate that we're nearly out of time, because it would be interesting to hear about how U.S. regulation impacts Latin America. I think that's a great topic, and Helena is an expert on that, so you guys corner her and talk to her about what's going on in Latin America. As far as banks and banks accepting Bitcoin, I would like to point out that we have some USAA people that have been attending the conference here. They are a remarkable banking institution, largely supporting the DOD, people in the military. And when they saw a lot of Bitcoin transactions being done by their customers with this silly thing called Coinbase somewhere, you know, they investigated it and decided this is something we need to support, and we need to support our customers in what they want to do. And I would hope that banks, and I would hope that our regulators would all look at what this technology can do, the jobs it can produce, the honesty that it can enforce. Immutable audits, come on, the SEC, you guys, you can't tell me that you wouldn't like to have immutable audits that are done in real time by businesses so that you can research whether or not they really did commit fraud. Because it's very, very hard to know what lie you want to tell tomorrow today. And so I would encourage you to look at Factum as a technology and how we can institute honesty. And that's where I'm going to go. I hit a bunch of things. And
if I can have about 30 seconds to wrap up, because, oh, I'm sorry, on the previous slide up there, I had several items. But I think sort of a common theme running through here is the issue of education. It's clear from Joel's perspective, you know, it's an education issue that the world he lives in is trying to get itself as educated as quickly as possible because of certain threats that they're trying to deal with. It sounds like the SEC is well along in that, but as the things change day to day, you're challenged to change with it. Obviously, what's going on in other countries, everyone's learning about this, but it's education that runs not just within the agencies, but it's also education within the industry. And it's imperative upon all of us to get up the learning curve as quickly as possible. And certainly Perry Ann and the initiatives of the chamber to bridge that gap, very important. So we thank you very much. There's obviously so much we could talk about. We had to pick and choose very wisely here, but we appreciate.
Well, we're going to have to cut. The trains have to run on time.
We'll be outside and can deal with specifics.
Is there safe harbor to store corporate records on a server in Chappaqua, New York?
Let's deal with it outside. Thank you.
I have negotiated. We
3 minutes. Okay, 3 minutes.
So we'll answer a couple questions, but only ones at the microphone.
So it's a race to the microphone.
Here you go.
Here, take this one.
Sorry, Eric.
11:20. All right, first comment on one of your slides, one of your bullet points had the word terrorism and Russia on the same bullet point. I think that is very unfortunate. Those are very different things.
It should have been / Russia, because it was pointing to the fact that OFAC has multiple programs, and they've got the Russian program right now. That wasn't a question.
So I don't know whether to pick on the SEC or more social issues. So let's stick to social issues. Just a two-part question. One, I would like, since you mentioned the magic word terrorism, I would really like you to define that. And second question, when you talk about the problems with Mexican drug cartels, you mentioned three. You said specifically prostitution, drugs, and kidnapping. So is there any consideration from the regulators? Well, if we regulate the first two, maybe they wouldn't create so much money for the cartels. Legalize the first two, wouldn't create so much money for the cartels. And to kind of prevent the third one of kidnapping, allow carry for pretty much everyone.
I assume that's to me.
Quickly.
The cartels are not made up of Mother Teresa or Gandhi. If we regulate, control something, they will find some other way of working the system to finance what they do. They are not going to truck driving school. They're going to find another way of extorting, seizing, taking money. They're already taking iron ore that's being shipped to China and trading it for precursor chemicals for meth. It's not a question of legality, it's a question of them finding a way of generating currency. No matter what we make legal, they will find something else to make. It may be child pornography, it may be child exploitation. Take your pick. Slavery, how much do you want to make legal to keep money out of their hands?
Well, the Kennedys did go into politics, right?
Okay, and we could, this is a great philosophical discussion. Let's see if we can get some specific regulatory issues on the table.
Hi, this is to the SEC guy. What was your name?
Tim.
Hi, Tim. Hi. I'm Eric Voorhees, former owner of Satoshi Dice.
Sure.
You may know who I am. First of all,
a brave man to be standing here.
Yes, well, I won't subpoena you for this information. I'll just ask it as a human to you. First of all, thank you for coming here. I know that you probably feel like you're going into the lion's den a little bit, and I appreciate that. My question is, don't you, and I know you're not representing the agency, so just person to person again, don't you feel that a prerequisite of an SEC action should perhaps be when people lose money? And if people have not lost money in some sort of investment, then why do you care, or why do you take action?
Sure, I hear what you're saying. And certainly, I think in your case and in other cases, it's not about people losing money. It's about people not complying with other regulations that require registration. And so the purpose of that registration requirement is to allow us to protect investors where, not in your case, but in other cases where people do lose money. For example, the Shavers case, where we want to be able to make sure we know what's out there so we can properly look for the disclosures that are there. So, and I think in your case, the specific regulations that were violated were about registration only and
sure,
not about loss.
But upon learning that money was not lost, wouldn't it be reasonable to drop a case?
Not necessarily, because that itself is a violation of the law.
I think a critical issue to point out about the SEC is that, unlike what we see in the anti-money laundering compliance area with FinCEN, and even with the bank regulators, the SEC is more hardwired as an agency and more ready to take action for clear-cut violations of the law. FinCEN and the bank regulators work on a very different path and can send often confusing signals as to what their expectations are, but the SEC is much clearer in that regard.
This is for the SEC. Obviously, I've done S-1s and Q's and K's for many years, but you don't regulate anything except equities, right? A different regulatory branch does exchanges, whether it's crypto to crypto or crypto to fiat currency.
Not necessarily, no. I mean, there are some bonds that are debt issuances that can be defined as securities.
Correct.
There are investment contracts that can be defined as securities.
Yes, yes.
So it wouldn't be just equities.
But the exchange of crypto to crypto or crypto to fiat is not either of the three you mentioned.
That those could certainly not be securities, absolutely.
Okay, and does the chamber have resources on your website that we can get information from?
Based on crypto to crypto, I don't have a microphone anymore.
The difference between crypto to crypto and crypto to fiat and the regulation as such, if you can contact us directly, we'll be happy to pull some resources your way. We don't have that specific issue on the website, but if you email us, our contact is on the website. We'll be happy to get you the information you need.
And the SEC has no safe harbor if we store records on Hillary's server for willful ignorance.
A safe harbor is a good piece that you bring up, and at the chamber we've had some discussions with the SEC about safe harbors, especially for small businesses and startups who maybe didn't necessarily understand the laws, but weren't hurting investors at the same time. So there is potential to work with the SEC on those types of issues, especially in such nascent types of topics where we haven't had any type of regulatory clarity either from these different agencies and departments.
I'm just gonna point out we're adding some time, so.
Thank you for that opportunity, Paul. So
to the state regulator, I pose to you the question that you think about the concerns of anonymity with Bitcoin or cryptocurrency perhaps, but yet the reality is really it's pseudo-anonymous. And in the previous presentation, gentlemen put a screen up, which Tone, thank you for asking him to go back to because it was worth taking a picture. And for your benefit, I want to read it to you. And it says, if only we had a way to track every transaction, know who sent how much to whom, and when the transaction occurred, and could exclude transactions that don't comply. Welcome to Bitcoin.
First of all, I'm a tremendous fan of Bitcoin. Read the same quote. I will assure you, they will find a way of hiding it. We ran to ground money that went to short-term banks on charter ships. The boat leaves the harbor, the bank has stood up. When the boat returns to harbor, it's shut down. And they transferred money through that bank by wire transfer because there's a casino on board. They're good. They're as good as you'll ever meet.
Real quickly, SEC, the effects of the Jobs Act coming, you know, to this point, where are we today and where are we going with that?
Sure. So I'm in the enforcement side. We're not per se a policymaking group, so I'm not necessarily the expert on the rules that have issued. But it's my understanding that there are have been proposed rules for the crowdfunding portion that are being issued as part of the Jobs Act. I don't think there's any final rules on those yet. This past Wednesday, however, there were final rules that were issued on what is being called Regulation A+, which is an exemption, or it's not an exemption, it's a Jobs Act prompted rule that allows for smaller raises of capital, but they've increased the max. So now up to $50 million can be raised through a more truncated version of the registration statement. It allows for, I believe, and this is all from a public press release that came out on Wednesday, it can be found on our website, would allow for solicitation to both accredited and unaccredited investors, and is really intended to meet the goals of the Jobs Act of making it, giving easier access to capital formation to companies without going through what was mentioned before, the large and what can be onerous at times, S1 requirements that very large established companies will go through.
Sorry to pick on the SEC person, but I have an SEC question as well. One of the interesting things in alternative currencies, cryptocurrencies, is people are issuing coins for money, mm-hmm. Money being Bitcoin, US dollars, Swiss francs, etc. How does the SEC define what a security is in light of what a coin is? Because for many points of view, they could be considered one and the same.
Sure. So we don't have any official position on that. I think what people who are involved in that kind of offering, or well, let me use a different word there because that has a special meaning in our world. Anyone who's involved in that kind of activity might want to consider, for example, whether it's an investment contract. So an investment contract is a security. There's a well-defined definition of investment contract, and that's if you're giving someone else money because of the expectation of profit in a common enterprise derived solely from the efforts of others. And in those instances, if there is an offering of coin that would otherwise fulfill all the elements of an investment contract, then it would be a security. It would be something we would have jurisdiction over. I think that there probably have been a number of those issuances that have occurred that probably fall outside of the definition of security, but that's not to say that there wouldn't be one that would fall within. And so you should just be mindful of that and you know, seek guidance on that if needed.
I'm going to interject here. Is the SEC mindful for the fact that companies like Factum are actually incorporating in London, where there are clear rules that we can follow to be legal, simply because of our business model requiring the use of a token to manage a distributed autonomous protocol? And because the SEC can't get their act together to make it seem even vaguely reasonable for us to understand whether we're following the law or not, we have to go somewhere else and put our businesses somewhere else. Is there some discussion like this at the SEC, and are they aware of the issue?
And can I go a step further on
sure.
that? Does it make any difference if a company is locating outside the United States but is soliciting funds from people inside the U.S.?
Sure, there's a whole extra analysis that goes on there. Generally, though, you would look to see whether there is an offering to U.S. investors in the U.S., what parts of that offering are taking place in the U.S. There's recent Supreme Court decisions that deal with all that, again, outside the Bitcoin context, but all of which would apply. I don't know if you want me to say we're very knowledgeable of Factum and we've been looking to you a lot or not. But no, I mean, just regardless of where you're located, if you're offering securities to United States investors and if there are certain conduct that's going on within the United States, then there could be jurisdictional issues.
Well, we're very careful not to be issuing securities.
Sure.
I mean, we're very, very careful not to be issuing securities. We're very, the Howey Law and making sure,
sure.
that we are not crossing that line. But that integrates in with you guys. I mean, how does it feel to be in Latin America and these, you know, a law in New York actually impacts Brazil? I mean, and that sort of stuff, and the SEC.
Well, Ismael? Yeah, so. Actually, what we have seen so far, also, first, Brazil really likes to pull the jurisdiction for cases, so it decided to tax everything on a worldwide basis, to regulate everything on a worldwide basis, so we kind of overlap there. And also, with regards to the SEC specifically, one thing I'm not so sure if I'm proud or not to say is that Brazilians usually copy a lot what you guys do. So basically, our resolutions in the Brazilian, it's called CVM, they are basically a translation of all the regulations from the Securities and Exchange Commission. So, of course, we could have problems on jurisdiction, but not on the regulations itself. And I'm guessing in the near future, we are supposed to copy the Jobs Act as well. I hope so.
We must be doing something, right?
Yeah. Well, and I wanted to also comment, because I feel like we're beating up on the SEC here when you say they need to get their act together and put out. I think it would... Yeah, yeah. But also, I think the industry has a responsibility as well to engage with the SEC and with others and to go in and state their interests and to explain to the SEC what the industry needs in order to operate. So, and that's, you know, the sole purpose of having a trade association is to be able and have to go in and have those types of discussions. So it's also the industry has a responsibility to work with their regulators, to work with their legislatures, to articulate the needs that they have in order to operate. And that's really, you know, a key function of what we do. And we'd love to have Factum engaged with our SEC task force that we've put together.
I saw that one coming. Well, I think we've got a couple more questions.
I just have one follow-on question.
Sure.
There's the question of what's a security and what's not is a difficult one. But then the second question is, how do you manage Reg S with regards to follow-on trades? Because if you're an American company and you list in Toronto or London, you have a Reg S issue, which means you can't sell back into the U.S. for 12 months. How do you regulate the exchange of coin that may not be a security or may be a security, and then you have Reg S, which has a trailing 12 month and a time period to deal with? How are you going to manage that?
I guess that falls under the we'll find out category.
Okay. Yeah, I thought that's what you were going to say. Okay, thanks.
And in my discussions with some of the SEC commissioners, the chairwoman she told us that she's twice gone to her general counsel and asked for jurisdiction over Bitcoin, and twice her general counsel denied her and said, no, you can't have jurisdiction over Bitcoin. And then she also testified in front of the Senate stating that the SEC does not have jurisdiction to regulate Bitcoin itself as a security. However, companies, you know, giving offerings, that's a different question. So we do have in testimony and in the congressional record the SEC stating they don't have jurisdiction. So that is a step forward in giving a little bit more clarity here.
But obviously, as we move into the world, further into the world of tokenization, that complicates
That's
the
a
issue
whole
significantly.
Different issue and question.
Well, hi, good morning. My name is Jason Seibert. I was actually the defense attorney in the Shavers case briefly. We've never met.
No.
And we've never discussed life, death, big city, Your excellent jacket, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I like that. One of the things that in that case was very interesting was the consistent demand for an accounting mm-hmm. of where the Bitcoin went. And I find it odd, and maybe this is an improvement in the SEC's processes, because the SEC was looking for a traditional accounting. Bitcoin in, Bitcoin out, where did it go, who had it? But all that information was in the blockchain. And you had that information, yet you continued to demand a traditional accounting. And Mr. Shavers continued to say, but you have the information. Has the SEC taken steps to learn how to read the blockchain? Or are they going to continue to demand traditional accounting systems? And I think these folks here would want to know, if they face an SEC action, what they need to be prepared to come forward to be able to answer those questions and say, look, I'm complying. I've done everything I need to do.
Right, sure, and I'm happy to address that. We have time?
Yes.
Okay, so three parts. Number one, the court ordered the accounting, I think, in that case and in all similar cases. So we did ask that Mr. Shavers comply with the court's order, and we would do that whether the damages were being denominated in Bitcoin or US dollars. So that is not an anomaly at all. You should assume that we have more than working knowledge of Bitcoin as far as how the blockchain works and what we can do with that. And as far as when people should be aware of the requirements of an accounting if they come into SEC case, it's gonna be the same whether it's a Bitcoin case or a dollars case. If there is like there was in this case, a TRO, there will be an accounting required by the court, and we will seek to have that. Just like your information is in a bank account that we might be able to go subpoena, you still have to provide an accounting of what's in that bank account, regardless of how it's denominated.
Tim's very modest. Tim has a tech background and is a programmer, has done programming in the past, so there is some knowledge there. I want to come back to one question that was raised earlier about the...
We have to
okay.
come. We're done.
But you do need to pay attention to knowing who you're doing business with. If you choose to be in business in this area, you have to understand there are laws that are around there that put obligations on you to understand who it is. So it's OFAC, it's the money laundering criminal statutes. So even though the technology itself lends itself to not having information about who owns it or whatever, if you're dealing with it, you do have obligations. And I don't want you to go away thinking that you don't.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to ask listeners to go to protip.is. You'll find a project backed by Chris Ellis, who has been heard on Let's Talk Bitcoin several times, and who I find to be a pretty amazing thinker and speaker. Chris's team is trying to create a new way for consumers to pay for online content, and I think if it works out, it could help move Bitcoin along its utilitarian path. And of course, it's also a step forward for content creators to earn a living. The fundraiser for this project ends on March 12th. Thanks so much for listening to episode 14 of The Bitcoin Game. Check out this episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com for links to topics discussed. You can also find a listing of all the episodes of The Bitcoin Game by going to thebitcoingame.com. Please let me know you listen by following or tweeting to The BTC Game on Twitter or by commenting on this episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com. Bye-bye.